go ahead and officially welcome everyone to today's CEC, or CERCLA Education Center's Preliminary Assessment / Site Inspection, or PASI, webinar series. Today we'll be kicking off that series with Module Number 1, an overview of the site assessment process under CERCLA. Our broadcast has been sponsored by the EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, and will run from roughly 1 p.m. Eastern to 3 p.m. Eastern today. We'll be joined by two instructors today, Therese Joya from Tetra Tech, as well as Jody McCarty from Tetra Tech, Inc. But before I introduce our two speakers today, I'm going to cover a few instruction items for those of you who are new. My name is Jean Balance, and I'm coming to you from that very same office here at EPA in the Technology Innovation Infield Services Division, where I'll be helping to run today's online webinar. So just as a reminder for those of you that might be new to the CLUIN webinar series, when you signed up for today's session, you should have received a registration email as well as a reminder message that contained all of the instructions you'd need to join us for the live broadcast. That email will point you to something known as the seminar homepage, where you can read more about the broadcast series, find contact information for our presenters and bios and links to their information. There are links to download copies of the presentation materials as well as to check out other resources. There's even a link to a short feedback form as well. But for now, to join us for the live broadcast, you're going to want to click a button labeled Go to Seminar that appears in the upper left corner of your screen. Once you click that button, you'll be asked to identify yourself by name, as well as the number of people at your location to check in and join us for a fully interactive broadcast online through Adobe Connect. Just a note, when you're checking in online, make sure you check in with the same first and last name that you used when you registered. So if your name is William, but you registered under the name Bill, you'll need to check in under the name Bill. Again, our entire broadcast is going to be delivered online using an interactive tool called Adobe Connect, which will permit our participants to listen and watch in real time as the presenters go through materials, as well as provide live demonstrations of software, and that'll take place in some of the later modules. If you have problems joining us online through Adobe Connect, you can simply download the slides and follow along via conference line, but there are some interactive components that you may miss out on. So we do encourage you to work with us to help troubleshoot any problems you might encounter to make sure that you can join us online through Adobe Connect for that fully interactive delivery. Again, we're going to have audio available through Adobe Connect by default for all participants, so you should be able to hear the entire session through your computer speakers or mobile devices headphones. If those online options don't work, the first thing you'll want to do is to locally check your own volume settings. You might need to go into the sound control panel or settings and increase your speaker output to make it loud enough. If that doesn't solve any online audio problems you may have, we do have toll-free call-in information for anyone who needs it. Simply use the Q&A window, which appears in the lower right corner of your screen, or refer back to your reminder email, and you should find the call-in information listed. Again, I can provide that with you now in the Q&A window if you don't have it. Just know if you join us on the telephone lines, you will be globally muted, and we ask that you remain on that global mute to minimize background noises and other disruptions on the line. We do have an interactive Q&A window, again, that appears in the lower right-hand corner. There's already a welcome message from me, Jean Ballant. You can use that window to privately submit your comments, questions, and to report technical problems at any time. In fact, if you're new to our webinar series, feel free to send in a real quick test message. You can simply click your mouse cursor on the empty box at the bottom of the field in the lower right corner and start typing away. Once you've entered it, you can either hit enter or press the cartoon-looking bubble to the right to privately submit your comment or question. So again, you can send in a test message to say hello or let me know how the audio and visuals are coming through at your location. Again, feel free to use that window with any question or comment, as well as to report technical problems or request the call-in number. If you are unable to resolve any issues online using the Q&A window, you can also send an email to balance.jean@epa.gov, and I'll be more than happy to contact you privately and help troubleshoot the issues you might have. Today's webinar is being recorded, and we will automatically send an email to all registered participants once that archive is available. So you can keep your eyes peeled for another email from me with all of the information on how to replay the broadcast. We're going to try as best as we can to get each archive available before the subsequent module in the series. This is a 9-part webinar series, so we're kicking off with Module 1 today on Monday, and we'll continue on with Module Number 2 on Wednesday. I'm going to try to get the recordings ready to go after today's live broadcast, but it's possible that we may not get the recorded versions done before we kick off the next module. However, once the entire series is done, we will have all 9 modules available to replay from the CLUIN archive page listed here. And you're certainly welcome to browse those sessions and take a look at the nearly 600 archived webinars that we have available for free replay online at that site. So again, just a quick overview on the visuals. You'll see a copy of the presentation materials here on the left side of your screen. If you have any problems viewing that, there's a button that appears in the upper right. It's a full screen button. It kind of looks like four arrows pointing in opposite directions. You can click that arrow button once to make the slides bigger, and you can click it a second time to shrink the slides back down. Feel free to go in and out of that full screen view as needed throughout today's webinar. You'll see our Cluin logo in the upper right, a collection of related URLs towards the middle right. Those are all interactive webinars, or pardon me, interactive URLs. You can click on any URL of interest and press the Browse To button that appears at the bottom to then open up that website locally on your own computer. So if you're looking for the slides, you'll find that on the seminar homepage as well as seminar resources page. And then, of course, our interactive Q&A window in the lower right. You can submit your comments, questions, or report technical problems here by typing up a message in the empty box at the bottom and pressing the cartoon-looking bubble to the right. All right, I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today's session. So I'm going to pull up the presentation, get ready to turn things over to your primary instructors for today's live broadcast. Again, you should be joining us for the CEC PASI module number one. And I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to your very first instructor, Therese Joya from Tetra Tech. Therese, please feel free to begin.
Thanks, Jean. Thanks for introducing this so well. And welcome, everyone, to the first of our nine modules in our training on preliminary assessment and site inspections under CERCLA. Hopefully, most of you had a chance to take the HRS course already. I think it's a good idea to do it sort of backwards, take HRS first. But if you haven't, we do have an overview of HRS, so hopefully that'll bring you up to speed if you're brand new to site assessment. So we really focus on, you know, what comprises a preliminary assessment and a site inspection. There are two distinct stages in the site assessment process. They have different scopes, and they have a different set of detailed activities that occur under each. So we'll talk about what all those are. We're also going to explain why you're collecting the information you're collecting, you're doing the activities you're doing. And those are really based in the statute, regulation, and the guidance that you're operating under. So we hope to infuse our discussion of what preliminary assessment and site inspection is, you know, with a good dose of where it all comes from. One of the most important parts of site assessment and conducting a preliminary assessment and a site inspection is to determine whether or not the site will score under the hazard ranking system model. And so we also discuss all of the HRS considerations that you need to think about when you're conducting a PA or an SI. And then finally, we'll go over the primary purpose of each of these steps and the fact that they are separate and distinct in the National Contingency Plan, and they're treated by EPA as largely separate and distinct, with decisions made at each point in the process. And then finally, we're going to give you an opportunity to practice. So a very nice tool that EPA has developed and really perfected here over the years is their software program called QuickScore. And we find that QuickScore is a really good tool to use at the PA stage as a way to try to plan and target your site inspection. And then, of course, it's also very useful for using to score sites. If your regions allow you to use this QuickScore program, you can use it to input your data, to collect your notes, and to generate your site scoring sheets. So we're going to give you a chance to look at how QuickScore works, and that really is associated with PA-level information. And then finally, we'll take a look at some SI sampling strategies, just based on good practices and, of course, being able to use resources wisely once you're in the site inspection phase. So by the end of the whole nine modules, this is looking, you know, 30,000 feet, you know, you should have a really good understanding, good enough to that you could explain how site assessments are conducted under CERCLA and the CERCLA authority behind site assessments. You should be able to prepare for, conduct and report on the results of a preliminary assessment, and you should be able, in a good position with maybe some help, to determine the need for a site inspection and then to plan, conduct, and report the results of that site inspection. If your site is going into a site inspection, it's likely it is headed toward potentially the hazard ranking system model, and you know, we recommend you have a good understanding of that too before you conduct site inspections. And then finally, we'll identify and use, show how we use the guidance and the software and the other tools that have been developed over the, you know, the many years that EPA and states and tribes have been conducting PAs and SIs. So there's a lot of institutional knowledge there at your fingertips if you're new to this arena. So EPA has been offering training on PASIs for many years now. And it's in its current version, it is a 3-day in-person training. And so what we have done is taken that 3-day in-person training and condensed it to these 9 webinar modules that will cover the same material. And the audience is the same audience that's always been intended, and that is the folks who do PASI work, primarily EPA regional folks, state personnel, tribal personnel, and then this is one Circle Education Center course where contractor personnel are allowed to take the modules. So it really looks at all those folks who support the site investigation and site assessment programs. And then, as I said before, we are going to apply the QuickScore software to a fictitious site, and that occurs during modules 3 through 6 as we go through the various pathways. So in order to receive credit for this PASI course, it is a CEC course, we recommend that you take each webinar in order, in the numerical order that it's given. It'll make more sense that way. If you can't attend one of the sessions being given on the web live, then you can go into the archive versions, and Jean discussed how to get to those. And then you have a two-month time limit to complete all 9 modules, get your certification, and then, you know, get credit for taking it. And there will be electronic certificates distributed to all participants who complete all 9 modules. Jean went over this, so this is sort of how all the modules are laid out. Module 1 and 2 are really foundational and are mainly lecture-based. Modules 3, 4, 5, and 6 are exercise-based with some lecture. And then 7, 8, and 9, we also have a lot of mini exercises in those to talk about various sampling strategies in the media, the various media that are sampled for purposes of site inspection. So the modules 1 and 2, a little lecture-based. The rest of them, a little more interactive. So here's some of the information we've made available. There's the participant manual that goes along with each module, and we have developed notes that go along with the slides. You can download the latest version of QuickScore from EPA's website, and you get the URL right here. It is free to download and install, and if you wanted to try to follow along as we do QuickScore, you could do that, and that again starts with Module 3. There's also the PA Guidance Manual and the SI Guidance Manual that are available as resources. All right, so let's talk about this little short module that we're doing today. It's really to give you a foundation in what, you know, where site assessments come from. So I'm going to describe the legal framework that we're operating under, which is the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, or CERCLA, also called Superfund. So you could think of those two as being equal to each other, Superfund and CERCLA. And I'll talk about how a CERCLA response is authorized for a specific release, and then what part the PASI process plays in that, and then the very basic steps in the CERCLA response process. And then Jody is going to talk about the rest of the items, which is how sites are identified under CERCLA, each step in the site assessment process, how they're different from each other, and what their scopes are, and then the roles and responsibilities of the different players that are involved in the site assessment process. So let's talk about the CERCLA statutory and regulatory background. So this is a pyramid, and it's really the top of the pyramid is where you find the most important part that informs your work. And I like to call it the big dog because it is the statute. It is what the law requires. And so whenever you hear anyone say, you know, that's a statutory requirement, that means it's written into the law itself. And so for CERCLA, that was first passed in 1980, and then its big amendment occurred in 1986 with the Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act, or SARA. So those two together are the main players in the site assessment process. CERCLA has also been amended in 1997 and in 2002 to address liability issues mainly associated with brownfields sites. And brownfields assessments are conducted, and they're quite similar to assessments conducted under the Superfund process, but it is a separate and distinct program from Superfund. Next in the pyramid, you will see executive orders. And that is really just the president who is being ordered under law to do certain things under CERCLA. All those authorities are given to the president by law. And so the president delegates them to the executive agencies to implement. And they have been delegated primarily to EPA and the Coast Guard, and also delegated to other federal agencies with hazardous waste sites on their federal property, federal land. So those executive orders really inform the executive agencies how to implement what the law and regulations required. And the primary regulation for CERCLA is the National Oil and Hazardous Substances Contingency Plan, or shortened the National Contingency Plan, or NCP. And you can find that in 40 CFR Part 300. And that is what I like to call the little dog. So it is codified. It went through federal rulemaking. It talks about, provides a framework for how we address releases of hazardous substances. So it's very important for the work that is done under CERCLA, the statute. It also talks about the lead agency concept, which I will talk about in a few more slides. It's also where you find the hazard ranking system model itself. That is Appendix A to the NCP. So the HRS is a piece of federal rulemaking, and it's the sort of rule that you're setting up to follow when you're conducting your preliminary assessment and site inspection work. And then finally, you know, the law and the regulation never answer all the questions that need to be answered. And so EPA has also issued a lot of policy and guidance with regard to many programmatic areas under Superfund. And they have issued policy and guidance for site assessments. Those are primarily located online with EPA's HRS toolbox, which is on the US EPA.gov website. And the two primary large documents, which we have provided as resources, the PA guidance and the SI guidance. So all of these things are important to understand and to refer to in order to do any work under Superfund, and that includes site assessment work. So a little bit more about CERCLA. It's quite unique in terms of federal environmental statutes in that it did create direct federal response authority to certain situations, hazards that are posed by abandoned or uncontrolled hazardous waste sites. And so it doesn't really regulate a particular entity. It provides authority to actually respond. And what can the president respond to? Well, he can respond to hazardous substance, which is defined in CERCLA, and it essentially includes substances already defined under other programs. Yeah, I'm just thinking I have a slide on that. No. So if it's a hazardous waste under RCRA, it's a hazardous substance under CERCLA. So the CERCLA umbrella is hazardous substance umbrella is quite big, and it includes all of the other federal statutes, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, TSCA, RCRA, FIFRA, all of those other environmental acts have hazardous substances that become defined under CERCLA. And it also includes authority to respond to a pollutant or a contaminant that may present an imminent and substantial endangerment. Now, there's actually a list that you can go to and see whether something is defined as a hazardous substance under CERCLA or not. And that list can be found at 40 CFR 302.4. And you'll see a few other things in there, like its reportable quantity. But you'll also see the statute from which that hazardous substance was derived. Now, for pollutants or contaminants, there isn't really a list. This is to cover those things that become a problem but are not actually on the list. And the most famous example is the anthrax bacteria, the bacteria that causes anthrax. As you remember, EPA did respond to the release of anthrax in Washington, D.C. and other parts of the country, and it responded under CERCLA authority by finding that the anthrax bacteria was a pollutant or contaminant. Now, the bar for response to a pollutant or contaminant is a lot higher than that for a hazardous substance. For a pollutant or a contaminant, EPA has to find that it may present an imminent or a substantial endangerment. For a hazardous substance, they just have to find that it's been released to the environment or that it is threatened to be released. So usually, pollutants or contaminants present situations that have to be addressed fairly quickly. And in my experience, the removal program is turned to a lot to address situations that involve pollutants or contaminants, much less so the site assessment or remedial program. So that's what CERCLA can respond to, or the president under CERCLA, and that president has authorized that authority all the way down to individuals that work for EPA. Here's how EPA can respond. They can conduct what is called a removal action, which is more of a short-term action. It's designed to stabilize or clean up a hazardous substance that poses an immediate threat to human health or the environment. There's also remedial actions that can be taken, and remedial actions are usually associated with longer-term, more chronic releases, and it is preliminary assessment and site inspection process that primarily feeds the remedial pipeline. There's a similar assessment process conducted under removal authority called a removal site evaluation, and sites can be referred back and forth from the removal to the remedial program. And then finally, the enforcement authority is EPA's ability to either compel potentially responsible parties or to come to agreement with potentially responsible parties on conducting CERCLA response actions. And those CERCLA response actions could be either removal or remedial in nature. It's when potentially responsible parties are taking the lead for conducting actions. And that's usually always conducted, done with EPA oversight. However, the preliminary assessment site inspection arena is one area where potentially responsible parties aren't given the lead for taking actions. That's primarily a government responsibility. So the key provisions of CERCLA was that it created the Hazardous Substance Trust Fund, which we all thought was gigantic at the time, and so we called it the Super Fund. And that's really where Super Fund comes from, this large fund. So it was $1.6 billion in 1980 and increased to $8.5 billion in 1986. And at that those times, it was primarily funded through a tax on crude oil and some commercially used chemicals. However, that tax expired and hasn't been reauthorized since 1990. And so cost recovery from potentially responsible parties and general revenues voted each year by Congress are now used to support the Superfund program. The CERCLA statute also is very strong in that it holds potentially responsible parties liable for cleanup costs, so for all the investigation and cleanup work that is conducted, and other costs such as natural resource damages. So there is a way for resource trustees to assess and collect for natural resource damages from potentially responsible parties through CERCLA. And then it also inventories and prioritizes hazardous waste sites for cleanup, and that is primarily what the preliminary assessment and site inspection feeds, this inventory and prioritization of hazardous waste sites for cleanup. So through each step of the process, the PA, the SI, the getting the HRS package, getting that ready, and trying to propose the site for the MPL, you are really inventorying and prioritizing. All sites do, as Jody will show you, all sites do not make it to the NPL stage, and so there's prioritizing going on throughout each of the phases of the process. And it turned out that CERCLA required EPA to find a way to inventory all of the sites that it thought it had in its universe, and there were tens of thousands in that universe, and then figure out how to go about attacking them, investigating and responding to the problems that they presented. And the way that EPA decided to do that was by establishing this hazard ranking system, a way to sort of mathematically score sites and sort of so that their problems relative to one another become obvious by their site score. And then selecting, they selected by policy a score that each site must achieve in order to be eligible for the national priority list. And that score is 28.50. Again, that's by policy. And then EPA had then established its national priority list, which gets added to periodically. So sites are still plugged through the process of the PA, the SI, and determining whether or not it can be proposed for the national priorities list. So it's really what our whole 9 modules are targeted at, making decisions about what goes into the big inventory, which is CERCLIS or SEMS, and then what gets winnowed down to go into the smaller high priority list, which is the national priority list. CERCLA also is very strong in encouraging and requiring the participation of states and tribal governments in response actions. And it is in the arena of site assessment where states play a very important role. Some states conduct through EPA funding, grant funding, you know, conduct EPA and SI and HRS, put HRS packages together for regions. And tribes can also get involved in that. So CERCLA is very strong in what it asks of states and tribes to do and in what it'll provide grant funding for. You all know also that CERCLA provides many opportunities for public involvement. It has really evolved over time, and EPA likes to use community engagement now instead of public involvement. In the site assessment process is really where a community may first become aware of a site. So there are opportunities to begin on the right foot for public involvement. And then finally, many provisions of CERCLA were designed to help advance the scientific and technological capabilities for cleaning up hazardous waste sites. Technologies have been tested, and there's been a lot of training given, and that is all funded by CERCLA and its mandate to actually advance the science and technology of hazardous waste site characterization and remediation. And this course is one good example of trying to advance the technological capabilities of those doing site assessment work. Just got to catch up with myself. Some of the key definitions that you need to understand in order to determine whether a site belongs in the inventory or how it should be prioritized, and those are presented here. So the definition of release is actually in both CERCLA and the NCP, and it includes a bunch of different kinds of terms for how these chemicals get into the environment and where they're coming from. And then a threatened release is a little more subjective. That has been defined by the NCP to mean that for the purpose of the NCP, release also means the threat of release. But that definition is not in CERCLA. And so over the years, through mainly court cases, it's the subjectivity of what constitutes a threat of a release has really come down to a few here that we list. If the owner lacks the expertise to handle the waste that is causing the problem at their facility, if EPA inspects the facility and finds that there are hazardous substances that are stored in deteriorating conditions, either tanks or drums, also if there's hazardous waste lagoons that are about to overtop, that are too full and don't have any freeboard left. So there's a bunch of several different ways that EPA uses to determine whether or not something constitutes a threat of release. Why you should know that as a site assessment person is that one of your responsibilities during a site assessment is to assess whether or not there are conditions that would pose a threat that might need a removal action. Now you as the assessor or the investigator don't make that determination yourself, but you should recognize when you should refer that site, probably through the region to the EPA regional removal program to determine if they'll want to make an assessment. So that's sort of why you need to have a little bit of the removal program in your mind when you're working in the site assessment program. I already talked about the definition of a hazardous substance, that it includes a larger universe than just RCRA or the Toxic Substances Control Act. But a few other things that we should point out here are that mixtures of hazardous substances and non-hazardous substances are considered to be hazardous substances. And that under the definition of a hazardous substance and actually pollutant or contaminant, you will find the petroleum exclusion. It's a very famous exclusion under CERCLA, and it says that petroleum, crude oil, natural gas are not defined as a hazardous substance or a pollutant or a contaminant. And it's usually when they, but if they are mixed with a hazardous substance later on, they could become a hazardous substance in and of themselves. So if you get a site where you think the petroleum exclusion may be coming into play, I would say you should get help with that issue. There are usually folks either within the state or the region that will know a lot about the petroleum exclusion and how it's being applied. And then finally, the definition of facility does come from CERCLA. And I'll just point out here that it's sort of tied to the definition of site, and it's important to understand that a facility can include areas outside of property boundaries. It can include the whole property boundaries and then all the areas where contamination has come to be located. So we'll talk a lot more about those two definitions, both release and facility, later on. So again, we have things that are not addressed under CERCLA, and this is where in the site assessment process you would want to make sure that the particular site that you're looking at doesn't fall under one of these types of releases that would exclude it from being a CERCLA response. So again, there's the petroleum, crude oil, synthetic or natural gas exclusion. Again, mixtures of petroleum and other hazardous substances make the whole thing a hazardous substance. However, just because you have some benzene in your gasoline, by nature doesn't make it a hazardous substance because it has benzene. So, like I said, get help if you don't think it's really clear about whether or not the petroleum exclusion applies. Also, if the release was federally permitted, then it would not be it would not fall under CERCLA. So an example of this would be if you had a discharge under the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System. So it's a discharge from some manufacturing or treatment facility at a plant that discharges directly to a surface water body. And if that if they never exceeded their permit for that particular substance, it was all within what was federally permitted, then of course that would not be considered a release of a hazardous substance. However, if they exceeded their permit limitations, then they would be responsible, and that discharge could be actionable under Superfund. This last one, we have a lot of text about it, recycling transactions. This was part of SARA, I believe. It has really never been controversial in my experience. It talks about when a recyclable material, when you wouldn't be considered to be a liable party if you were just recycling a material. So there's a definition for recyclable material. But like I said, it's really never come up as a big issue in my work. So finally, these activities listed in CERCLA 104A3, so CERCLA is the statute. These are statutory activities that are exempted from federal response. So this is the big dog saying these are the sorts of things that CERCLA cannot respond to. So that includes naturally occurring substances that are found in their original location. So the classic example of that is radon. So if you have radon entering a building from the natural formation, that is not actionable under CERCLA. However, if you moved materials around that contained this, that contained radon and moved them to some other place and built something on it, then they're no longer naturally occurring because you had moved the material. So you really need to look into the details of every situation you encounter in order to make a determination of whether or not any of these exemptions apply. The next one is from products that are part of residential business or community structures. The classic example there is asbestos. And then finally, the hazardous substances that are released into public or private drinking water supplies as a result of the deterioration of pipes. And the classic example of that is lead. So those are three statutory situations that that Congress didn't intend CERCLA to respond to. However, there is an emergency exemption so that in case of an emergency, EPA could respond to one of these situations. So, and that's usually the case in most statutes. So here are some situations that CERCLA cannot respond to. These are would be considered to be releases, but it's not CERCLA. So it would be for workplace exposures. That is addressed under OSHA. For vehicular engine exhaust, that's addressed under a whole different program. For certain radioactive contamination, there's the UMTRA program, and there's also a certain type of radiation that must be addressed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So EPA does, and Superfund does respond to radioactive contamination. It just has to be a certain type to be exempted. And then finally, the normal application of fertilizer. People often think of this, too, as the normal application of pesticides. And they really both fall into the same category. Normal is defined as the what the labeling instructions for the fertilizer or pesticide say that you ought to do. And as long as those instructions are being followed according to the label, then that would be considered to be the normal application of fertilizer or pesticides. So when you read the NCP, as I know you all go out and do, spark your interest there, you'll see that much of the subpart E language is written in terms of lead agency. So you need to understand what lead agency means. And what the NCP means by that is the lead agency is the one responsible for planning and implementing the response action under CERCLA, and they supply the on-scene coordinator and remedial project manager for those activities. Now, lead agencies can include either EPA, the U.S. Coast Guard, other federal agencies like the Department of Defense and the Department of Energy. They are the lead agency for activities on their federal property. And then states and Indian tribes can also have lead agency authority. And so the on-scene coordinator and the remedial project manager are the federal officials that are designated by the NCP to coordinate and direct removal and remedial responses. And in this day and age, site assessment managers may also be remedial project managers in the regions. So, and it is what site assessment managers hope to move their site to, right? From if they only do site assessment work, then their ultimate goal should be to, you know, get some of these sites through the process and either into the archive or on the national priority list, whichever is most appropriate. But the many of the activities conducted in the National Contingency Plan and the cleanup and investigative activities are conducted by individuals working as a team, and that team is led usually by either an on-scene coordinator or a remedial project manager, sometimes both. So this is a grand overview of the whole response process under CERCLA. First, sites are discovered or EPA is notified about a site, and then the site assessment work begins. I think I lost the green thing. I have not used it. So the site assessment process begins, and when we say assessment here, we mean the assessment work that occurs during the preliminary assessment and site inspection, as well as the assessment work that is conducted in the next phase of the process, which is the remedial investigation and feasibility study. Then decisions are made, and in the removal program, those decisions result in an action memorandum that discusses what the agency is going to do and the conditions that prompted their action. In the remedial side of the shop, it is a record of decision, usually. And after records of decision are signed, you can have explanation of significant differences that also talk about sites and the decisions made. Then you have the real work that comes, which is cleanup. That occurs much more quickly in the removal program and is subject to both time and dollar limits. In the remedial program, that is, you know, where remedial design and remedial action occur, and it's where the actual work is getting conducted and the site is being made safe. So here in that assessment that you do in PASI leads to that cleanup someday, and that's a good thing to be a part of. And then finally, when all that work is conducted, there is a closeout process that occurs. And then all throughout the process, you have potentially responsible party involvement. EPA does have an enforcement first policy, and when it does have viable potentially responsible parties, it will try to engage them involved at the site. And then finally, community involvement and community engagement, which occurs throughout the whole process. So we talked a little bit about the Department of Defense and Department of Energy having lead agency status, and that's because they have a lot of actual facilities where they were building and manufacturing and you know, making the same sorts of messes that were being made on the private side. So those federal facilities have a whole section that's devoted to them in CERCLA Section 120, that talks about how they need to evaluate their sites and how they need to sort of be part of the CERCLA response program. And there were special timetables and requirements that applied to how they conduct their site assessment work. And then these federal agencies cannot use the Superfund trust fund monies to conduct their work. They have to obtain their own funding from within their own budgetary process. Otherwise, they will treat their sites going forward just like any other facility or any other site that is on the national priorities list. They have to follow all the requirements. All right, I am done with my section. I guess we'll open it up if anyone has questions.
Okay. So just a gentle reminder for participants who are joining us, you can submit your comments and questions using the Q&A window that appears in the lower right corner. We do have a few typed up questions that have already come in, so we'll start with those, but you can go ahead and start typing some up, and we'll try to get through a few of them while we can on our break. If you're joining us only on the telephone lines, we do apologize. We're going to try to keep the questions only coming in electronically to try to minimize on background noises. So I think you've addressed one of these already, but we did have one participant who just asked if you can confirm if these rules include radioactive materials.
Yes, they do. CERCLA defines many radioactive substances as hazardous substances. Okay. And they have many sites that on the NPL that address radioactive substances.
Okay. We also have another participant that asks if you could please state where the hazardous substance list can be found again.
It's 40 CFR Part 302.4. That's actually a big table.
Okay. And one of our other attendees would like to know where they could get copies of the NCP.
You can, I think, obtain them online, okay. You know, download a PDF.
Okay.
I mean, we have them on our CD resource, but I don't think they can get to that.
Okay. We'll work to try to get a link to the NCPA because I know it is available online as well.
I mean, and if you really want to get the most valuable part of the NCP, in my opinion. You should try to get the March 8, 1990 Federal Register version, which has the preamble, which discusses all sorts of things that you need to know about if you're going to work in the CERCLA program.
Okay. And then we did have another participant that just included a note. We shared this note earlier with everyone, but they commented that Quick Score was available from, I think it was a different URL that you had included initially. So we did make sure that we have updated URLs, and we did share that corrected Quick Score URL with everybody. So we just wanted to draw everyone's attention to the URL that appears in the Q&A window. And we also do have another comment here from one participant who states that over time, reuse has played an increasing role and endpoint for our CERCLA sites. Is reuse considered in the statutory or regulatory framework of CERCLA?
I think it is indirectly in the terms of the risk assessment, which should focus on, the projected reasonable future use.
Okay. All right. I don't see any other electronic questions, although I do have a few people who are chiming in at various websites where we can find the NCP, as well as a few other resources as part of that the CFR that you had mentioned earlier. So thank you to those participants who are sharing those URLs and resources. We'll work to get those posted and share them with everybody as well. So I think we'll go ahead and take a pause from the questions and carry on with the technical portions of the webinar today.
All right. Thank you, Jean, and thank you, Therese. So now the last part of our webinar today, we'll go through the actual site assessment process under CERCLA. So let's take a look at what that process looks like. We'll talk about each one of these boxes in more detail as we go along, but just to kind of go over them a little bit, the first step is the pre-CERCLA screening. So this is where we actually look to see if a site is even eligible to be assessed under CERCLA. After that, it goes into discovery and notification. And after that, you can either go into a preliminary assessment, which we'll talk about a little bit more, or even a removal action. The site could also go into no further action planned. It could be deferred to another program. It could also then, depending on the outcome of the preliminary assessment, go into a site inspection, then into your HRS package, and then finally placement on the National Priorities List, or the NPL. And one thing to keep in mind throughout this whole process, you'll see if you look at the various arrows and the directions that they're going, that really at any time in the process, the site can, it doesn't always follow a direct path. It can go in different directions. So even if you are in the site inspection phase of the process, you could still possibly, go into a removal action if site conditions have changed and a removal action is now warranted. Or site conditions have changed and maybe now there's no further action needed after you've done the site inspection. Or maybe now it's more appropriate for it to be handled by a different program. So that's just one thing to keep in mind as we're going through this, that at any time, if site conditions change or additional information is discovered, your site can, get pushed into a different direction than what you think it might go. What you would think would be discovery, do a preliminary assessment, go into the site inspection, then do your HRS package, and then place it on the NPL. There's other things that can happen. So let's talk about the pre-CERCLA screening first. That's the first step in this process. And this is really meant to be a cost-effective method to determine if your site should even be entered into the CERCLA database. A lot of times what happens is before pre-CERCLA screening was done, sites were entered into CERCLA multiple times. This was either because maybe its name changed or, just simple errors like part of the name was spelled incorrectly and it looked different enough that, someone thought that it was a completely new site. So doing this pre-screening process is really supposed to help count down on the number of duplicates that are entered into the system and then also just make sure that the correct sites are being moved forward in the system so that EPA can focus its resources on the sites that are eligible for assessment under a CERCLA response, instead of, you know, doing a lot of assessments that are not necessary. Sometimes during this, there can be a little bit of sampling that also can occur. Usually this is just done in case the screening questions, which we'll go over in the next few slides, in case those cannot be answered, then it might require a little bit of focus sampling to get those answers and see if you should move forward into the discovery phase. So let's look at some of the screening questions that we do. First question that we want to answer, is the site currently in CERCLIS under another name, or has it been archived in CERCLIS? So again, this is just making sure that we're not duplicating efforts and we're not putting duplicate entries into the system. This will also look and see if the site has already been archived. But even if the site has been archived, if there is new data or information available, it can still be assessed, and that might change its status. The second question we want to look at, is the site or some contaminant subject to limitations under CERCLA? So usually there's three statutory limitations under CERCLA where this could happen. One is if there was a release, if the release is a naturally occurring substance in its unaltered form. Second, if the release is from products that are part of the structure of a residential building or business or community structure. And then the third statutory limitation is if the release is into private or drinking water supplies due to a deterioration of that system, just from ordinary use, nothing just out of, you know, ordinary use of that system. The next question, is a state or tribal program in the final cleanup phase at a site? So if there is a cleanup going on that is being done by a state or a tribal partner, then usually EPA would wait until those actions are completed, and then assess the site at that time, and then determine if it should move forward and should be entered into CERCLIS. And then, is the hazardous substance release subject to a statutory exclusion? So these are the exclusions that Therese mentioned. So the biggest one, the Petroleum Exclusion Act, you'll want to ask, is it does it fall under that, and then would not fall under CERCLA regulations? Following with some more of the screening questions, is the hazardous substance release at the site deferred by a policy? So is the site already being handled by another program? Maybe RCRA is already doing, has a corrective action going on at the site. So that would be the program that would handle that instead of falling under CERCLA. Is site data sufficient to determine CERCLA's entry? So do you have enough information? Is it reliable that you can use to determine if the site should move forward? If not, maybe there might need to be a little bit more data collection done at this point. But you'll want to make sure that that data that you have is determine if it's sufficient or insufficient to move the site forward. And then, is there documentation that clearly demonstrates that there is no potential for a release that could have an adverse effect on human health or the environment? So if you have information about your site and it documents that there's not a potential for a release that could affect human health or the environment, then you would want to have that documented, and you would want to know that, you know, at this point that site could be screened out and would not need to be entered into CERCLIS. Some of the data that you might want to have to document this is if you have data from a remedial investigation that shows that some of your ARARs are not exceeded. If you have a removal action that was completed at the site that shows that all of your sources and releases have been addressed by that removal action. Also, if there's any reports that might show that there's not a release of a hazardous substance that has occurred at the site. So if you have no release of a hazardous substance And then if there's been a risk assessment that was completed by the EPA that shows that there's no risk. Those would be examples of documentation you would want to have to show that the site should not be entered into the database. So once we do our screening, the next is our site discovery and notification. So under this, Section 103 of CERCLA, and then Part 304, known as EPGRA, which is the Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act. So both of these establish requirements so that a person that's in charge of either a facility or a vessel is required to report the release of a hazardous substance or an extremely hazardous substance into the environment. These releases are reported to the National Response Center, or the NRC. Depending on what the substance is and the location of the release, the National Response Center will be the ones to determine who would handle that release. So if it would go to an on-scene coordinator within the EPA, or if it would be an on-scene coordinator from the Coast Guard. And then if these persons in charge of the facilities or vessels fail to report a release, there are penalties. There's fines that are outlined in Section 103B of CERCLA that they would result in either some kind of monetary fine or possible imprisonment. Other ways that a site can be discovered, perhaps, you know, a state agency or another federal agency is out doing an inspection, and they either discover a release that has occurred at the site that they are doing their inspection at. Another way, sometimes federal or state authorities also might just go out and do inventories at sites that focus on what hazardous substances are there and if they might pose a threat to human health or the environment. The news media. So, you know, maybe you have a media investigator who's out and maybe comes across some suspicious activity or, you know, maybe a possible release from a facility in their area. That's another way that a site can be discovered. And then there's also citizens' petitions. These are from Section 105D of CERCLA. And what this does, it gives the public the opportunity to send a PA petition to the EPA, and this notifies the EPA of a suspected environmental problem that might be directly affecting the citizens in their area. And this gives the citizens a way to be a part of the program. And it's also a way that, you know, maybe sites that may not have been identified are now identified because of something that someone, you know, within the community observed. So now that we have discovered the site and we know that it meets our requirements to be assessed under CERCLA, our next process is to actually do the preliminary assessment. So what this does, the PA is meant to be really a low-cost way of determining if a site is releasing or has the potential to release a hazardous substance, a pollutant or a contaminant into the environment, and then also if it requires action that can be authorized by CERCLA. So during the PA, you're using existing information that you have to determine if a release is serious enough to require either additional investigation or some type of action. At this time, you're compiling all the information that you have that's available to you about the site as well as its surrounding environment. And this can include information on sources that are at the site and what types of waste they contained or still do contain. What are the different migration pathways that those hazardous substances can migrate from the sources in the site? And then also, what are the receptors? So what is this? What are these hazardous substances affecting? And sometimes during the PA, you may also go out and do a site reconnaissance. So you may actually visit the site, be able to look around, see what's there, confirm information while you're on the site visit that, you know, you have from your background documents or the existing information that you have reviewed. And then the PA, what you'll do is you will have a report after you conduct the preliminary assessment. You do give formal recommendations in it, and really the point of the PA report is just to decide if the site does have the potential to adversely affect the environment. It's not necessarily a report that's going to say the exact magnitude of the release, give, you know, nature and extent of the site and the contaminants there. It really just is, does the site have the potential to cause harm to the environment, human health, and should it move on to the next phase, to the site inspection, or does it warrant some other type of action, maybe an imminent threat that would move it over to the removal program? So the goals of the PA, there's really four goals that we look at. The first one, again, is to eliminate a site where a remedial action is just not really required. You know, there's no threat to human health, there's no threat to the environment, or maybe there's just no further action warranted under the remedial program. The second goal is to identify sites that require emergency response. So just like I said, maybe you know, you've come across new information, or when you did your site reconnaissance, you noticed something that might show an imminent threat to human health and the environment that might need to move this site over into the removal program to do either an emergency response or a time-critical removal action. And then one of the other goals is to compile information to develop a preliminary HRS score. So if you do think that the site, you know, poses a threat and there is, you know, it does seem like additional remedial action is necessary, then your information from the PA will help you to determine a preliminary hazard ranking system score, a preliminary HRS score. And so what's important about that is that'll help you as you move forward to determine where you should focus your efforts on during the site inspection, as well as where your site falls in the site on the priority list to actually do a site inspection. You know, there's a lot of sites out there. There's a lot of sites that get screened. We'll look at a graphic a few slides later that kind of shows the whole process and how many you start out with and then how many actually get placed on the MPL. But, you know, the PA can give good information to, you know, say, okay, does this have a high priority to, you know, we need to do the site inspection right away, or is it, you know, is this site a little bit higher than this one? So, you know, it'll give you a good idea of where you need to move forward with in the SI process. And then the last goal, again, is just to set the priorities for the site inspection, which I touched on a little bit. But once a PA is conducted, all of the sites are placed into three different categories, either high priority, low priority, or no further remedial action planned. So having as much information as you can in the PA will help your site get in the proper placement of either high, low, or no further action needed. So there's also what is called an abbreviated preliminary assessment, or an abbreviated PA. EPA has guidance for conducting an abbreviated PA if your site is, if you're able to do an abbreviated PA at your site instead of a full-blown preliminary assessment. But really the purpose of the abbreviated PA is to, you know, a lot of times EPA, because of their experience and, you know, with doing so many site assessments and having so many sites, you know, they'll often be able to determine if a site should be removed from the process altogether with less information available or required than if you go out and do a full-blown preliminary assessment. So this is really to see if you don't have to spend the money to do a complete PA, if you have enough information to do an abbreviated. One of the differences with this is a lot of times an abbreviated preliminary assessment will rely a lot on professional judgment and just past site assessment experience to make decisions about the site instead of maybe going out and doing a site recon or collecting some additional data. You're really relying on professional judgment here to do this. But you want to try to use the same information that you have for the conventional preliminary assessment. And this will also, your abbreviated PA, you'll also have reporting requirements for this. So you will have a report at the end that you'll need to make sure meets all of the CERCLA and NCP requirements as if you were doing a preliminary assessment itself. Now, there's typically three different situations where an abbreviated preliminary assessment can be done. The first one is if your site has just been listed in CERCLA unnecessarily because it's really not eligible or because it could be deferred to another program. So that's a situation where you could do an abbreviated PA and just document your findings and document why you're making that decision as to why it's not eligible or if it should go to another program. Another one is if you have information that allows EPA to make an early decision that it either needs to go directly into a site inspection or maybe another Superfund investigation. And then the third, again, if you know that a no further remedial action planned decision can be made without completing the full preliminary assessment. Again, just based on the information that you have, you already know that there's no threat, and you can document that, and so that would be another, your third situation where you could do an abbreviated PA instead of a full-blown PA. So again, what are the possible outcomes of an abbreviated PA? Again, like we talked about, you could have no further remedial action planned under the Superfund program. You could defer it to another federal program. You could also, if the state or a tribe is still involved doing an active response at the site, you could delay the decision until they're finished and then assess the site once that's been completed. You could assign it a high priority for further assessment or a low priority for further assessment. It could also be referred to the removal program, or it could also possibly be incorporated into an existing site. And again, I mentioned that there are reporting requirements if you do an abbreviated PA. The abbreviated PA report should meet the same requirements that are set forth in the National Contingency Plan. And you want to make sure that you're presenting and supporting all of the information that led you to the decision that you are making or recommending. There's also an abbreviated preliminary assessment checklist, and that should be included also as part of your report. And there's actually a copy of that checklist if you do download the participant manual at the very end of this module. There is the APA checklist is included. So after we've done our preliminary assessment and we've determined that there has been a release or there is the potential to release from the site and it does warrant additional assessment, then our next phase is going to be the site inspection. So that's our third phase in the site assessment process. It's a very flexible process. It's not going to be the same for each site. You're going to be looking at different things. You're going to be moving forward with different things depending on the threats and conditions that you have at your site. So you're going to be using the information that you collected during your preliminary assessment, and you're going to be using that to see where you need to focus your site inspection efforts on. Usually, this is where you will collect samples Typically, in the other, during the PA, you may not collect samples, but usually during the site inspection, this is the first time where you're having field activities, where you're going to be going out, collecting samples, waste samples, environmental samples. They're going to be very focused because you're going to want to show and document that there was a release, you know, of a hazardous substance to a receptor, or that you have. And so typically during the SI stage, you could collect anywhere from 12, maybe all the way up to 35 samples could be collected. We'll talk a little bit more, I believe it's in Module 7. We'll talk about some strategies, depending on what your pathway is, of where you should focus your sampling efforts, depending on if you're looking at groundwater, if you're looking at surface water pathway. So we'll talk about, we'll get more in depth on those specifics when we get into Module 7 and 8, I believe it is. And then you're also, the site inspection, you also have a report that comes out of that, and you have a narrative report that summarizes what you know about the site, the activities that you conducted during your site inspection, and then all the information that you researched, and it'll also have your score sheets that are showing what your what the potential HRS score is for the site now that you have all this new information that you've collected during the SI. So there's three goals that we look at during the site inspection. First one is to obviously collect or get additional data to evaluate the release that has the release or the release potential. The second is to again screen out sites that will not score high enough for placement on the MPL. So this is another stage where after you've collected some more information, you know, maybe you've determined that we don't have enough here. There's not, you know, maybe there was a hazardous substance present that you thought in the PA was present, and now that you've done some additional work, it's that information was incorrect. So one of the goals here is, again, to screen out those sites that you don't have enough information for that are not going to score high enough to be put on the national priorities list. And then again, as we've mentioned before, you know, site conditions can change. So again, if there is anything that has changed at your site that now requires it to move back into the removal program and either have an emergency response conducted or a time critical action, this is another time where the site could move in that different direction depending on what the conditions are. So after the site inspection, the next, and you've now determined that there is still a threat, that you do have enough, that it will, a high enough score that it can move on and be placed on the NPL, the next thing you're going to look at is putting your hazard ranking system package together, your HRS package. The HRS is the principal mechanism that EPA uses to place hazardous waste sites on the national priorities list. It's a screening system that uses information from the PA and the SI, and it assesses the potential of these sites to pose a threat to human health or the environment. And what it's looking at, it's a structured approach. It assigns numerical values to different factors that relate to risk, and these are based on the conditions that are at the site. There's three of those. One is likelihood that a site has released or has the potential to release a hazardous substance into the environment, characteristics of the waste that are at the site, and then the different targets that can be affected by the release, so either people or sensitive environments. And again, the HRS, this your final output for the HRS is a scoring package. This gets sent to EPA headquarters. And a complete HRS scoring package consists of a site narrative summary. So again, this is just everything that you know about the site. The HRS documentation record, this also would have your HRS score sheets in it. Completed copies of referenced reports, so any reports that you referenced, any maps that you might have used, or any other documents, those would need to be included, and then other information as appropriate. So maybe if you have some interviews with people that you documented, any analytical data that needs to be included, all of that will be part of your HRS scoring package. So the HRS scores four different pathways, and for those of you that have taken the HRS course, you know these by heart. We've got the groundwater migration pathway, surface water migration pathway, the soil exposure, and then the air migration pathway. The groundwater pathway looks at drinking water threats. The surface water migration pathway looks at drinking water, human food chain, and sensitive environment threats. Soil exposure looks at the resident population, nearby population, and sensitive environments, and then air looks at population and sensitive environments. And scores are calculated for one of the pathways or more than one of the pathways. It just depends. You know, sometimes you'll have a site that does not, you know, there's no kind of documentation that there's been a release to air, so you may not even score that. You may not even take the time to score that pathway, but you know, you might score groundwater and surface water. So it just depends, but scores are calculated for either one or more of the pathways, and then they're combined and you get an overall site score. And typically, groundwater and surface water are the two pathways that are scored the most. Groundwater is usually scored 50% of the time, and surface water is scored 52% of the time, and followed by soil exposure at 16%, and then air migration just scored at usually 7% of the time. So once you've put your HRS package together and you're showing that your site meets the criteria to be placed on the National Priorities List or the NPL, that's the next step in the process. And this is something, it is required of CERCLA. The NPL is just, it's really a list of national priorities where there are known releases or threatened releases of hazardous substances, pollutants, or contaminants throughout the United States. It was really developed as a management purposes to just let states, the EPA, and the public know which sites or facilities in the United States may need remedial action. There are rules that EPA must follow, rules and procedures that they must follow when they're trying to place a site on the national priorities list. Part of this process, they must issue a notice in the Federal Register proposing that the site be placed on the National Priorities List. They must obtain public comments on this proposal, and then they must issue a notice of final rulemaking in the Federal Register and respond to any of the comments that were received from the public. And CERCLA requires that EPA updates the National Priorities List at least on an annual basis, and this update is published in the Federal Register. So how can you get a site placed onto the National Priorities List? So the first way is through the hazard ranking system. So if your site scores 28.50 or higher using the hazard ranking system, then that site is eligible for placement on the National Priorities List. And this is actually the primary mechanism that's used to place sites on the NPL. The second one is through state designation. So each under CERCLA, each state has the ability to designate a single site as its top priority, and this does not matter on what score the site received during the hazard ranking system process. So it does not have to be above a 28.50. This is just a state designation. They can recommend this as their top priority. And most states have done this already. I actually looked it up today before the webinar, and there's about 16 states that or territories that have not used their state designation yet. And then the last is either if the Agency for Toxic Substance and Disease Registry, so that's ATSDR, if they recommend a site be listed, or if EPA determines that a release poses a significant public health threat, that's another way that it could be put onto the MPL. Or if EPA also anticipates that it would be more cost-effective to use the remedial program rather than removal authorities to clean up the site, then it could also be proposed for the national priorities list. So there's also another way to kind of get sites cleaned up but not place them on the national priorities list, and this is the Superfund Alternative Agreement approach. Again, this is just an option where a site does require long-term cleanup or long-term response. It is eligible to be placed on the MPL, but it hasn't been listed. EPA they've established criteria for designating a site as a Superfund Alternative Agreement site. And obviously before this is done, there needs to be some consultation and notification with all of the interested stakeholders before this can move forward. There is guidance that came out in 2002, and then it was revised in June of 2004, that just kind of sets what the general approach is for designating a site as a Superfund Alternative Agreement site. And really, you know, the whole goal of this was to try to provide a process where you could get settlements and cleanups that were equivalent to those that you would get from an MPL site, but you didn't have to list the site to keep adding to those that were on the national priorities list already. So if a region would want to designate a site as a Superfund Alternative Agreement site, it needs to meet the criteria set forth in the National Contingency Plan. So it must have an HRS score that's greater than or equal to 28.50. And then it must require some type of long-term response or action. Because Superfund monies for remedial actions are limited to sites that are on the MPL, usually these Superfund Alternative Agreement sites are PRP-led sites for the remedial action. Again, I mentioned that, you know, EPA and the state need to agree on making the site into a Superfund Alternative Agreement site, and then make sure that they're coordinated in their response. The state should be involved in long-term planning and also at key decision-making points. During the RIFS, so the Remedial Investigation and Feasibility Study, when EPA is selecting a remedy, the state should be involved in that during the proposed plan and then during the record of decision. Again, you're trying to get the same cleanup out of this site, just not putting it onto the MPL. So remedies that you're looking at, you should consider anticipated future land use, and then also ensure that you're complying, that your remedies are complying with NCP requirements. And then the regions also need to make sure that they have other enforcement options available to them if the PRP is unwilling to agree to the provisions or if they possibly breach the settlement agreement that had been put forth and before the site turned into a Superfund alternative agreement and they started work. So they just want to make EPA will have some enforcement options in place should that happen. So we've talked a lot about CERCLA's, and for those of you out there that might know this, the EPA has been implementing a new information system called SEMS, the Superfund Enterprise Management System. So CERCLA's is or was, however you want to look at it, it was EPA's database that and their data management system that pretty much tracked any information that you would need to know about a site. Sites were started, EPA started adding sites to CERCLA's back in 1980. In the past, usually once it was entered, it could not be removed, but today sites can be archived in CERCLA's if they are deleted from the National Priorities List. And then CERCLA's also can contain information on initial discovery of the site all the way through to deletion from the NPL. CERCLA's had information about planned and actual activities at the site, financial information about the site. Really anything about the site was captured in CERCLA's. So now EPA has developed its new information system, again, SEMS. And so right now, the data from CERCLA's is being migrated into SEMS. SEMS is going to be able to enhance data control, data quality control. They're trying right now. The goal is hopefully by the end of this fiscal year, it will be up and running, and they've already done some testing in all of the regions with the remedial project managers to show them how to enter things in SEMS now and where everything will be found. So really at this point, while CERCLA's is housed in SEMS and EPA is still converting its system into SEMS, the thing to remember is, though, the questions that you asked during that pre-CERCLA's screening, those still need to be answered. Those are still going to be the set of questions, no matter if you call it, if it ends up being called pre-SEM screening or if it continues to be called pre-CERCLA's screening. Those questions are still the questions that you need to, that need to be answered during that initial process. How PASI data is going to be entered into SEM, that'll be up to EPA. And it'll be publicized by EPA once those decisions are made and once the conversion to SEMS is 100% complete. So we just kind of wanted to make you aware of that, you know, we still did use, we use CERCLA's, the lingo CERCLA's in here. That is what is required by the NCP, so that's why we use it. But they are transferring to this new system. And once kind of all that is hashed out, that'll, EPA will let you know how that PASI data will be entered moving forward. So again, I did mention that sites can now be archived. This is, again, if you have information throughout the process that there's no type of further Superfund work to be done at the site. So no additional site assessment, remedial action, removal action, even enforcement or cost recovery. None of that is being planned for the site or conducted at the site. So then at that point, a site can be archived. When a site is archived, if site conditions change or, again, if new information becomes available, some reevaluation work can be done while it's still archived, but then if that reevaluation work determines that there's been a pretty substantial change at the site or if cleanup work is warranted, then the site returns back into the inventory and is no longer archived. Let's see. Okay, so the different, the basis for archiving sites in the CERCLA or SEMS system, if you have a site where it's either been given a no further action or it's been deferred to another program and no other Superfund activity is anticipated, it qualifies to be archived. If removal and site assessment processes have been completed and no additional, or if just a removal action was completed and no site assessment work is needed, and there's, again, no further Superfund activity is anticipated, it can be archived. If a site has successfully completed state deferral, and again, no further Superfund activity is anticipated, it qualifies to be archived. A site was removed from the proposed national priorities list or the final national priorities list, and again, no Superfund activity anticipated. Child sites. So these are addressed as part of a parent, either NPL or non-NPL site. As long as there is no further Superfund activity at the area considered the child site, that can be archived as well. However, a parent non-NPL site should not be archived until all the related child sites have been archived. And then sites that have completed either other cleanup activities by a non-EPA party under the site assessment process and, again, have no other Superfund activity anticipated, those can also be archived. And, again, as I mentioned, you know, this can always change if new information becomes available. You know, a site can be put back into the inventory in order to be assessed to see if those new conditions warrant some further action. So this is the graphic that I talked about a little bit earlier. That just kind of, it gives you a good idea of, you know, how many sites can be screened out during the process. This is from fiscal year 2011, so you can see that 538 sites went through pre-CERCLA screening, and at that time, 80% of those were able to be screened out. So that's a pretty big number. So a lot of the sites are being screened out prior to the discovery process. 206 sites, a preliminary assessment was conducted at those. The average cost was about $14,000 per preliminary assessment. And after that, 46% of those were able to be screened out. Those that moved forward into a site inspection, that was 88. The average cost of each SI was about $45,000. And after that, about 53% of those were screened out for one or more reason. And then some had an additional assessment done on them. The average for that was about $35,000, and at that point, 58% were screened out of the 167 that had an additional assessment done. And then 23 actually went in to do an actual HRS package, about $65,000 a unit, and then those are the ones that moved into, that were proposed for the national priorities list. So you can see that, you know, it started out with a good deal of sites being screened, and we ended up in that year with only 23 that were proposed for the national priorities list. And again, if a site did not go proposed to the NPL, it was either NIFRAP, so no further remedial action planned. It could have been deferred to another program or even to the state or another federal agency or other cleanup authorities. So it could have gone to the removal program, maybe brownfields, something like that. So now let's talk a little bit about the roles of everyone who is performing site assessments. So the NCP determines the lead agency responsible for planning, a response action under CERCLA. And so EPA is designated as the lead agency for implementing any response actions. This includes site assessment activities at a site, as long as it's not under the jurisdiction of another federal department or agency. The EPA is responsible for reviewing every HRS scoring package, and the EPA is the only agency that can place a site on the national priorities list. So that's their responsibility during this process. States and tribal governments, if they're operating under a contract or a cooperative agreement or even a Superfund MOA, a memorandum of agreement, they could also serve as the lead agency for an action, and they can also perform site assessment activities. And then, as Therese mentioned, the federal facilities, the NCP assigned the federal facility the role of lead agency for implementing CERCLA response authorities at sites that are under, DOD or DOE jurisdiction. And they have special requirements that and timetables that they need to follow. So CERCLA established these special requirements for the federal facilities, and the first is the creation of a federal agency hazardous waste compliance docket. So this just lists, it's a docket that just lists all of the federal facilities that have reported managing hazardous substances, or they've had releases of hazardous substances at their facility. They're required to be put on this docket. And the docket is required to be updated biannually. Another requirement that they have is that the preliminary assessment and site inspection must be completed within a reasonable time frame. So once the federal facility gets listed on the docket and it's determined that a PASI needs to be conducted, it needs to be conducted within a reasonable time frame, and EPA has decided that a reasonable time frame is 18 months. So once it is listed on the docket, then the PASI needs to be conducted within that 18-month time frame. Once the PASI is done, then EPA looks at the site again, and it determines if the site should be listed on the NPL. And then they also have the RIFS needs to be within 6 months of being listed on the NPL. So again, if it is decided that the federal facility needs to be placed on the national priorities list, CERCLA says that facility needs to begin a remedial investigation feasibility study within 6 months, and this needs to be done in consultation with the EPA and the state involved. It's required that both EPA and the state must publish enforceable timetables and deadlines for the RIFS completion. They also must review the RIFS report as well. A few other requirements for the federal facilities. This is also from CERCLA. Section 120 says that federal facilities need to enter into a federal facility agreement or interagency agreement with the EPA for any remedial action at sites that are on the NPL within 180 days after EPA has reviewed the remedial investigation feasibility study report. The agreement also states that EPA has the authority to select the remedy that will be conducted at the federal facility if it's on the NPL. And then also the last requirement, if there's a transfer of federal property, again, Section 120 of CERCLA, it gives many requirements if there is going to be a transfer of federal property. Some of these are there has to be a notice in the contract to sell or transfer federal property that describes all of the hazardous substances that have been stored at the federal facility for a year or more, or that are known or that they know have been released or were disposed of on the property. So that information has to be disclosed in that contract. Also, in the deeds that transfer the property to another person, there needs to be information that that all remedial action has been taken to protect human health and the environment with any type of hazardous substance that remains on the property still. And then an investigation of uncontaminated property at facilities on which federal operations will be terminated and at installations or bases that are closing or realigning. So they'll do an investigation of those properties to ensure that they are uncontaminated. And then finally, there's a notification of states regarding certain leases. So again, if it's a federal facility, they have some requirements that they'll have to, that are specifically set out in CERCLA that they'll need to follow. All right, so community involvement, Therese talked about this. This is really something planning for community involvement should begin during the site assessment phase. It goes throughout the entire cleanup process. During the preliminary assessment phase, really the most important thing is to designate a community involvement coordinator. Maybe also call maybe some key local officials just to let them know that, you know, you're looking at a certain site so they're aware of it. They might have some information that becomes helpful to you that they might be able to share. If a response action is expected to last more than 120 days, though, then there are community involvement activities that have to be planned for that are outlined in the NCP. And then another thing, too, just planning for community involvement, as we talked about during the site inspection, that's typically where you're going to do your first maybe some invasive sampling. So you might have some sampling teams in the field that are dressed out, you know, wearing protective clothing. Usually this kind of you know, community members might notice that a little bit more than somebody just walking around the site. So it might be a good idea to just, you know, kind of let some community members or surrounding residents know that you will be working on the site and what you'll be doing, just to give them, you know, a heads up as a courtesy, so they're not worried one day why somebody is out there in white Tyvek, you know, digging soil up out of the ground. So again, we mentioned, you know, designate a community involvement coordinator for the site. Maybe distribute some fact sheets. So this could be either fact sheets that talk about the work that is being performed or that you're going to perform at the site, or even maybe what some of the hazards are at the site, just to give the residents in the community an idea about what's going on there. And then any kind of, you know, maybe issues, news releases, or updates, just to let the community know, you know, what part of the process you're at, what you're finding, just to keep them involved and up to date on the site. We mentioned this earlier. If a site is proposed for the national priorities list, the public is offered the opportunity to comment on that proposed listing. This is something that the EPA must allow the public to do. You might also have a public meeting that can be held in conjunction with the proposed site listing to give people an opportunity at the public meeting to discuss any of their concerns or questions. You also, these reports, they are available to the public. The public does have the right to look at a PA report and an SI report, especially those that result in a no further remedial action planned decision. So these are, you know, kept in some kind of deposit repository or a docket where they are available to the public to review and comment on. And then these same reports can also be part of an administrative record. And the administrative record is all the documentation that supports what the agency's decision is. In the removal program, that's called an action memorandum or an action memo. But these document all the information that was used to make the decision for the site. So in this instance, to propose it for the national priorities list. So all that information will need to be kept and put in there. Okay, and then we'll look at just a little bit into other federal cleanup authorities and programs that can be used. So there could be response actions under the Clean Water Act as it was amended by the Oil Pollution Act, or OPA. So the Clean Water Act gives the federal government authority to respond to the release of either oil or hazardous substances to navigable waters of the United States. The Clean Water Act also established the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund, which helps to finance cleanups of releases of oil and hazardous substances to the navigable waters. The Clean Water Act also gives provisions that assigns liability to responsible parties to clean up the damage that was caused by the discharge of oil. And all of these are performed in accordance with requirements that are under that are in the National Contingency Plan, or the NCP. Also, RCRA is another program where it has three major regulatory programs. So you have the Hazardous Waste Management, which is Subtitle C, Solid Waste Management, Subtitle D, and then the Underground Storage Tanks program, which is Subtitle I. And under each one of these different programs, there's requirements that compel the owners or operators to investigate any releases and to clean up releases of solid and hazardous waste, hazardous constituents, or regulated substances that have gone into the environment. RCRA can be delegated to the states, so sometimes the state will oversee the RCRA enforcement action at a site, which is something that can't happen at CERCLA sites. And then there's also the Safe Drinking Water Act, and we talked a little bit about TSCA, the Toxic Substances Control Act, which regulates PCBs. And then some sites, including the federal facilities, which we've already talked about, they have releases that are subject to CERCLA and other federal laws, so they might be integrated because there's several different types of mechanisms that they can come together to look at the different cleanup requirements that are under all of those programs. RCRA is another example of that. You also have the state and tribes that play a role in the cleanup of sites. Most of the time, it's the states and the tribal representatives and their programs that are overseeing assessment and then cleanup of a lot of the contaminated sites that are in the U.S., particularly those that are lower risk or non-NPL sites. So sometimes state and tribal programs will only focus on CERCLA-regulated sites. Other times they might focus on both CERCLA and RCRA-regulated sites. And others might also include sites that are in the Brownfields program, in the state voluntary cleanup program, or maybe other redevelopment authorities that are out there. I mentioned just now the voluntary cleanup programs in the states. So this was prior to the Brownfields program. EPA established this framework for negotiations between the states and EPA regions regarding the use of the state voluntary cleanup programs and other state authorities available to clean up contaminated sites. So the Voluntary Cleanup Program Memorandum of Agreement, MOA, this was in 1996. EPA issued guidance on this, and it established six baseline criteria for the voluntary cleanup program. The first was to ensure that it provided meaningful opportunities for public involvement to keep the public involved, ensure voluntary approaches used are protective of human health and the environment, that the program had adequate resources to ensure cleanup was performed in a timely and appropriate manner, and then to provide mechanisms for written approval or response and certification of completion so that they could document that the action had been completed and completed properly. That they have the ability to provide adequate oversight during the action, and then to show capability of ensuring completion of long-term activities through operation and maintenance or long-term monitoring. So again, that they have that ability to conduct the O&M or any type of long-term monitoring that needed to be done at the site. And then there's also the RCRA Memorandum of Understanding. States and tribal governments, they also have established MOUs with EPA, regions regarding the coordination in if they fall under the RCRA corrective action or other RCRA cleanup authorities. So we'll go through the summary really fast, and then we'll see in the last 7 minutes or so what kind of questions we can answer for you guys. In summary, so again, Therese went over, you know, CERCLA, it enables direct federal response to the release of hazardous substances and pollutants or contaminants into the environment. You'll remember it authorizes three types of response actions: removal, remedial, and enforcement. It's the National Contingency Plan that assigns roles and responsibilities to responders. Certain releases are excluded from CERCLA response authorities. Remember, the biggest one is petroleum exclusion. Sites are assessed upon discovery or notification of a release and then entered into CERCLAs or SEMS. Sites are assessed using a phased investigation. So remember, this starts out with the preliminary assessment, and then if it's deemed that it has the potential to release a hazardous substance, it moves on into the site inspection where further investigation is conducted to see if it needs to move on into the HRS, where an HRS scoring package and documentation record is put together to determine if it's a candidate for placement on the MPL. You'll remember the HRS is the primary mechanism for putting sites on the MPL, and that cutoff value is 28.50. And then again, at any time during the assessment process, a removal action can be taken if the conditions warrant that. If they change, it can always go back into a removal action or be deferred even to another program, federal agency program, or the state. So with that, I'll just let you know our next module is going to be this Wednesday, again, from 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern, and this one is going to be on the basics of performing a site assessment. And then we'll also talk about actually conducting the preliminary assessment. So we'll go through, you know, actually doing a PA where, you know, what the information that we have, where you find that information, what you're looking for, all that good stuff.
Okay, let's try to get through some questions in the few moments we have allotted. So we did have a number of them that have come in electronically throughout the session. Let me just start reading through. One of our earlier questions that came in is, who's responsible for entering a site into CERCLAs?
So that's actually, so EPA would be responsible for doing that.
Okay. And what is the deciding factor as to whether or not government funding will be provided for site investigation and remediation, or whether the property owner or lessee is going to be responsible?
That's mainly EPA's call on the strength of their enforcement case, but they will always pursue enforcement first, and make the liability and viability assessment of the PRPs as an internal agency decision, internal enforcement discretion.
Okay. Is a site visit optional, or is that required for a PA?
That's optional. It's not a requirement. A lot of times it won't be done just because, as you probably saw on that, two PAs are usually fairly inexpensive, or they try to be inexpensive. So it's not a requirement. It's just an option.
Okay. Another participant would like to know if an HRS can be completed with just a PA only.
I don't see how, unless you had really good existing data, because usually you get your data, your analytical data, from the SI.
Okay. Can you comment if vapor migration is going to be added to the HRS in the future?
How to do that, Jody?
sure. It is being evaluated right now. They are looking at adding vapor intrusion into HRS. I think right now at this point they're still looking to see where it makes the most sense in the sense of not creating a new pathway, because that would take, you would have to change the rule, and so that would take a lot of effort. So I think right now they're just looking to see in the existing framework where is the best place for VI to be included.
Yeah, I think EPA has done their work, and the proposed rule has been at OMB for some time now, and I'm uncertain whether OMB has started the 90-day clock on its review or not. So stay tuned.
Okay. We have a number of people that are asking how many sites actually make it onto the NPL. You commented that 23 sites were proposed, but of those, how many actually make it on?
Oh, what's the rate of proposal to finalization?
Yeah.
I don't really know, but I get the sense it's pretty darn high, because EPA is very QC conscious of its HRS packages. But I don't know if you know, Jody. I don't know.
I don't have the exact number. I mean, we could probably go back and use one of the fiscal year ones to see, in fiscal year 11, did all 23 make it onto the NPL? I think that's kind of a high number, but I think, like Teresa said, it would probably be a good, I don't think many of them would not, just because of the amount of effort that, you put in to get it that far.
Okay. Just for participants who are able to still stay with us, we do have a number of questions. I'm going to take just a few more moments to get through a number of questions, and then we'll walk through some final reminders and close things out today. If you do have to hop off, we have provided the link in the Q&A window in the lower right corner where you can provide feedback as well as to download the seminar slides. So let's carry on with some of these questions. One of our participants wants to know, does archive equal NFA, which I believe stands for no further action?
Not really. NFRAP is a sort of a different designation than no further action. You usually see no further action used for a site that has undergone some action as removal, and then determined that they need no remedial action because the removal action took care of everything. That's where you usually see no further action in regard to a Superfund record of decision.
Okay. All right. Can you elaborate on when and why a site would be considered under the Superfund alternative agreement approach rather than pursuing formal listing like an NPL site?
It's usually at the request of the potentially responsible parties who don't want the stigma of having an NPL site of owning an NPL site, and it's a lot of that is related to future redevelopment of the property. And so it would be at the request of the PRPs to EPA to do the Superfund alternative route instead of the more traditional route. My understanding is they're done in Region 5 and 4 most aggressively, but not so much in the other regions.
Okay. We did have a comment that on one of the slides you had a mistake in one of the acronyms, and it should be FFA rather than FAA. So just a note. I did notice that it looked like throughout almost all of it, it was listed as FFA, but they just wanted to comment on that.
Okay.
We also have a question, another just clarifying statement, that it should be made very clear that EPA has joint remedy selection with the federal facility sites. EPA has sole authority only if the joint selection cannot be reached. They just wanted to make sure that was clear if some people weren't certain based off of what you were sharing.
Yeah, that is correct, as stated.
Okay.
It's really only when they get into a dispute that EPA sort of rules or wins the day, but that doesn't happen very often.
Okay. Should every inquiry from the public or media for a site discovery be viewed as valid and then proceed in the CERCLA process?
Oh, boy. Say that again.
So they want to know if every inquiry from the public or media for site discovery, should we automatically look at those as valid requests and then proceed forward in the CERCLA process? So in other words, as soon as somebody proposes a site, so if a community comes forward and says we have a site, we think this should be listed, is that automatically considered a valid enough request to then start with the site review process? Or is there some degree of reviewer scrutiny on the initial request before they even start walking through with the CERCLA process?
Well, there is a petition that members of the community can petition to have a preliminary assessment conducted. So there's sort of a formal petition process you can go through, and those are addressed by EPA in their formal process of looking at petitions. Otherwise, I think EPA uses all of its information sources to determine what they should go forward in pursuing.
Okay. We also have another participant. Just a few people were asking with questions regarding to RCRA. One participant would like to know if you could elaborate on why a site may be a CERCLA PASI versus a RCRA regulated site.
Well, there were some sites that sort of fell through the cracks between RCRA corrective action and Superfund and were placed into the CERCLIS. And once the site goes on to the CERCLIS list, they have to start walking through that PASI process. And so I believe what they found was that there were sites that really should be going forward under RCRA until RCRA can no longer take them further. And then they could maybe be assessed to see if they are a Superfund site. Otherwise, I think the agency has been deferring to RCRA when the site is actually a RCRA site that could undergo corrective action under RCRA authority.
Okay. And I think just related to that, we have another participant who mentioned that their site is regulated under RCRA. If we had a release, we would have to clean it up in accordance with the state's risk reduction program. Does this constitute our site being excluded from CERCLA under those exclusions?
It by policy. So that is a policy decision, the RCRA deferral one. It's not a statutory exclusion under CERCLA. So it's by policy that EPA is decided what goes into the NPL box and what stays in the RCRA corrective action box. So it doesn't, quote unquote, exempt you as in a statutory exemption, but it does sort of line up with, you know, that particular site would go forward under RCRA authority based on how EPA has been deferring sites to RCRA authority that belong in RCRA.
Okay.
We
have a couple people just kind of commenting about the difference between RCRA and CERCLA. And they're going on to say that RCRA facilities are typically active waste management facilities, and CERCLA is generally for abandoned or closed facilities. that it's possible RCRA sites can wind up on a CERCLA list, but that's rare that that would happen, especially if there is still an active facility that's capable of cleaning up the active waste from their activities on the site.
Right, because there are a bunch of federal, they have to have financial assurances under RCRA that they have to show, so I think that's correct, that a RCRA site could end up becoming a Superfund site, but the agency likes to keep them in the RCRA program.
Okay. If it is a federal facility, should the hazardous waste compliance docket still be updated biannually, even after the FFA is established?
I am not sure about that answer to that question.
All right. How about asking about what's the best way to coordinate federal interagency reporting and coordination? Would the EPA or the Surface Management Agency be the ones conducting the PASI?
Is this a federal facility question again?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, the federal agencies themselves conduct their PAs and SIs, and then EPA reviews them.
Okay, so if it was a Department of Defense site, they would do the PASI and then EPA would review it?
Yes.
Okay. All right. We have a question. Does EPA conduct the HRS scoring, or is a PRP a responsible party? Are they also allowed to do it?
EPA does it, and PRPs do not do it. They comment on the package that's proposed to the NPL, but they don't get involved in the agency's preparation of that package.
Okay. Is there a decision time frame for EPA to notify placement or denial of proposed sites to the NPL? Can any remedial investigation or action occur at the site in the meantime?
I don't think that there's a time frame other than you get, I believe it's a 30-day comment period, and then EPA just takes the time necessary to review and respond to those comments. And what was the second part of the question?
They just wanted to know if while we're waiting for it to actually get scored and decide if it's going to make
so
it on, can they do
proposed,
anything?
Yeah, I remember now. When sites are proposed for the NPL, EPA starts the RIFS process.
Okay.
Upon proposal, not upon finalization.
Okay. And then another question, can, as far as private parties go when they're releasing contaminations, can you walk us through the basic steps of reporting the release?
Yeah, they would need to determine whether or not they have a reportable quantity that meets the definition under CERCLA Section 103. And then if they have met that reportable quantity, or if they're not sure and they just want to make sure, then they would call the National Response Center and report what it is they released, where it is, and what they're doing about it. So they would have to provide a lot of information once they report to the National Response Center.
Okay.
And the National Response Center is manned by the U.S. Coast Guard, and then the U.S. Coast Guard folks collecting those release reports determine which region to send that release report to, so that eventually, in a quick time frame, it either goes by telephone or by fax to the spill phone in each region, and then an on-scene coordinator is looking at that release information to determine if any federal response is necessary.
Okay. We have one last question we'll take, and this is
the only other thing, Jean, I want to say
there are
significant penalties for failing to report, either in a timely manner or by not providing accurate information. So, and the burden is on the regulated community that is potentially releasing chemicals into the environment.
Okay, so here's the last one. Do you know how often is the groundwater to surface water component for the surface water pathway used rather than an overland flow component to score the surface water pathway? So this is an HRS question.
Almost never.
Okay.
So the 99% of surface water pathways are scored on the overland component, and very, very few on the the groundwater to surface water component.
Okay. All right, well, that's the end of the online questions that we have, and I think in the interest of time, I'm going to walk everybody through just a few reminders and close things out. We are going to carry on with the webinar series this coming Wednesday on July 2nd at 1 p.m. Eastern. We will continue on with the series with module number 2. As was mentioned earlier, it is encouraged and highly, highly recommended that you participate in all 9 modules in numerical order. So we're going to work to get this recording processed as quickly as we can and at least get out a preliminary recording link so that if you missed the full live delivery today, you can catch up before we kick off module number 2 on July 2nd from 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern. And if you haven't, you can sign up for the other modules in the series visiting our CLUIN live training calendar. We also get a lot of requests for people oftentimes asking for training certificates. We don't issue those on our CLUIN webinars, but we do have an online lookup system. You can visit the following website at cluin.org/training/records. And on that page, you can actually enter in your own email address and just click the Submit Request button. And that'll actually email you a table of every single webinar that you've ever signed up for using that email address on our system. So a lot of people find that to be helpful when trying to keep track of their webinar training. As we mentioned earlier, the slides, as well as a number of other resources, including that SI document and the PA documents, are available to download from the additional links or resource page. These links are active from this point forward. You'll find it on the middle right of your screen under related URLs as a seminar resources page. You can click that and press the Browse to button to open up. That also works for those of you replaying the recorded version. Those links are still active for you. We also are going to ask participants to take just a brief moment and fill out our short feedback form. If you do fill out that form, I promise you I will read each and every one of those comments, and we'll continue to work to try to improve both the delivery mechanism as well as the content that we present. If you shared the line with multiple people, each person can actually hop on and fill out their own feedback form. And again, if you don't have time to fill it out live or you're replaying the archived version, you can still submit feedback following those links. We do see a link under related URLs for the feedback form. If you're looking for additional documentation for your online attendance, be careful when you're filling out that feedback form. Make sure your email address is entered correctly, and you check the box that's circled in red over here. If you check that box once you submit feedback, there will be a confirmation email sent to you for your own records. A lot of times people think they filled the form out, but they fail to check that box. Checking that box gives us a release or approval to send you another email confirming your participation. And a lot of people who are trying to get CEUs or PDHs find that if they have the slides, they have the registration email, and they get this confirmation email, that's enough to document their full attendance with their accrediting organization. If anybody has any other questions or comments, feel free to send me an email at ballant.jean@epa.gov. I want to thank the over 120 people who signed on live from all over the world to join us for today's live broadcast. And I hope we will see you or hear from you on the future webinar in the series, again, carrying on July 2nd with module number 2 at 1 p.m. Eastern. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.